Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight I'm delighted to say we have another author joining us tonight in the centre circle. But before we introduce tonight's guest, obviously big hellos to my co-commentators on such an occasion. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, you must be happy today. Must be.
Oh, what a day, what a weekend. You know, that's just been outstanding. With winning goals in the fourth minute of injury time, thanks to VAR, you know, confirmed penalties, Manchester City tripping over themselves again, you know, Man United struggles, you know, it's really appealed to my Liverpool supporting side. I know I keep on saying I'm a Liverpool supporter, but I'm a football fan in general. Well, the football fan in general can do one this weekend. This has all been, up until this podcast, of course, this has all been my Liverpool supporter kind of like getting a bit of a good weekend on the go there.
And so I've never heard you talk like that before. You've always been so magnanimous, come win, lose or draw, but this is different...
None of this. Even Everton slipped into the relegation zone. I'll calm myself down. I'll be back to normal within the next 3 minutes, I promise.
Brilliant. That's just not what I was expecting. I was expecting it, yeah, but still a long way to go and it's this and it's that. But no, I like this version of you.
No, we've got an international break now for 2 weeks, so we know that we can't kind of like, you know, burst the balloon for 2 weeks now. So it's kind of like, just enjoy it for at least 7 days before you start to panic about the next game.
Is it Manchester United your next game?
It is.
Oh, I tell you what. If you could write it...
Oh, indeed.
Brilliant. And obviously, my other co-commentator on such an occasion, like I said, Mr. Gary Thacker, who must be equally as happy with the result and, I suppose, how things are going with your club. Gary, how are you?
I'm all right, buddy. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'm well chuffed. I think Frank is doing a fantastic job and the transfer ban might turn out to be the very best thing that happened to my club for a long, long time. You know, we've got young kids coming through from the youth team that, you know, I've been dominated the Youth Cup for, I don't know, a dozen years or so and had no players come through the first team. All of a sudden, look what's there. Look what's there. We've got a young kid who's equal top scorer with Aguero in the league. You know, we've got Hudson Odoi back. Good day. And Steve, my wife's team, Wolves, turned the city over for Stevie, so she's happy as well. And the only down cloud on my horizon was we went to watch Torrevieja get beat 2-1 at home. Lunchtime, but aside from that, all is good, buddy. All is very good.
I was going to say, Mrs. Thacker must be just as delighted as you two guys, I think, this afternoon.
Yes, I was watching the Chelsea game and she was watching the Wolves game, and all of a sudden, this yelp come out. I thought, well, it's either a cockroach or the Wolves scored. Fortunately, it was the latter.
Well, I don't want to bring the mood down in any way, but obviously, just in case anybody on this podcast was wondering, Hull City lost 3-0 away at Huddersfield, so, you know, that's that mood brought down for us all, just like that. But we'll progress, we'll kick on. Tonight's guest, the book we're looking at, guys, tonight, I think... certainly, obviously, the subject matter is certainly from my perspective, and this is probably an age thing, but it's certainly something that it's one of those subjects where I thought I knew, but turns out I actually didn't really know a lot at all. I don't know about you, Gary.
Absolutely agree, mate. Yeah, and you know, the subject tonight is a legend of football, but certainly even before my time, mate. And by Christ, that's saying something.
I know you're normally our go-to person for memories on these sort of subjects, but yeah, I think we're all tapping in the dark tonight. Stephen, yourself, were you aware of much?
Same. I mean, I being a product of the Northwest, you know, always been aware of him and the impact that he had on Bolton Wanderers. His part in winning the 1958 World Cup and that infamous goal with Harry Gregg. And being on the pitch for that wonderful Matthews final in 1953. So I've known bits about him, but it's more like signposts than actual, you know, across the board, knowing huge amounts about him. And tonight will be great.
It will. So, yeah, I suppose we should... At least we've got one expert on tonight who is going to know a lot about this subject, and that's the author. So tonight's book is Lofty, and it's by Mr. Matt Clough. Matt's been writing about sport for as long as he can remember, I think. Got serious about it about 7 years ago. Massive reader. Over the years, he's read all about the contemporaries around Nat Lofthouse, Stanley Matthews, Tom Finney. When it came to trying to learn more about Nat Lofthouse, found that the information was surprisingly limited, which is good because it gives me a reason for not having as much knowledge as I probably thought I should have done. And it set about trying to research as much about him as it could, really just to satisfy his own curiosity. As time wore on, found out more and more about Lofty and couldn't escape, really, the feeling that it was a story that deserved telling in its entirety. And I suppose, you know, like we've just mentioned there, guys, it's, you know, the signposts, as Stephen said, and it's probably a little bit, there was more of a story to tell. And Matt seems to have done the perfect job. So, Mr. Matt Clough, welcome, and thank you very much for producing the book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
No, people never need to thank us for the invite on. Trust that the gratitude is all ours. Trust me, you never need to thank us. We're just grateful to have someone to talk to who's different to Gary and Stephen, really. So, Matt, you know, the book's yours. You know, it's a wonderful book. But I suppose, you know, before we start getting into the detail, a little bit, you know, sort of two questions as always that we'd like to start off with. One, you know, why not Lofthouse? You know, we've mentioned that, you know, you struggled to find information about him, and, you know, and you know, how come this was the subject you chose?
So I'm a lifelong Bolton fan. Like you say, he is the kind of definitive Bolton Wanderers legend. We've got the Nat Lofthouse stand. We've got a pub named after him in Bolton. Well, it's called the Lion of Vienna. We have a statue outside the stadium. And really, he's a name if you grew up as a Bolton fan, even like if you're like me and didn't actually grow up anywhere near Bolton. It's a name you can't go too far from without hearing, basically. You know, if you mention to anyone that you're a Bolton fan, even fans who are sort of decades too young to have seen him, they know the name Nat Lofthouse, and that's the name they immediately gravitate towards. And you've really hit the nail on the head, because I, like you guys, I knew the kind of broad strokes about Nat. I knew about the 58 final, the 53 final, obviously his legendary record for England, 30 goals in 33 appearances, which is not too shabby. But beyond that, I didn't really know all that much. And like you said in the intro, I kind of started researching in order to satisfy my own curiosity. And as kind of I got further and further into the research, I felt like it was a story that deserved telling. And I also felt by trying to kind of give a bit of context around that, I'm not trying to claim I've enhanced his legend in any way, but I felt for me personally, I had a closer connection to him and a greater respect for what he meant to Bolton Wanderers and what he did for Bolton Wanderers, knowing a bit more about him. And yeah, I just thought it was eventually something I deserved sharing, and I wasn't sure if anyone else was planning on sharing it, but I guess I've got there first. And like you say, it's a pretty fantastic story of a true legend of the game. I'm not quite sure how it had gone sort of really untold for so long, but that's hopefully what the book's done.
I suppose my own personal curiosity, as I suppose, like I said, I do this all the time. I always get the first question in because I'm supposed to be the one in charge. But anyway, it gives me freedom to get the first question in. And I suppose something that a little bit, we've talked about, well, we've sort of mentioned and alluded to already just in the opening parts, that this sort of gap in knowledge, if you like, of such an iconic figure. And I suppose once you started doing the research and, you know, and talking to other people, was there the same opinion as to, yeah, actually, you're right, there is, you know, there is a story here that needs telling, there is a bit missing. You know, could people sort of put the finger on why it was, why there was a gap?
Yeah, there pretty quickly I did kind of establish there was an interest in it. Like you said in the intro, again, I've been writing for various places, and it was actually a piece I wrote for These Football Times about Nat, which I then kind of, you know, shared on the usual places, which got a really, really strong response, and people sort of saying, you know, even in that short piece, it was probably only about 1,000 words long, there was information that they had no idea about. So, for example, one of the kind of the prevailing myths, legend about Nat is that he was a diehard one club man, never even countenanced for a second the idea of leaving Bolton Wanderers. As I found in my research, and as I mentioned in the These Football Time piece, that wasn't entirely true. There were times when his head was slightly turned somewhat, and there were times when he wanted to stay and the club were quite willing to cut him loose. So just that kind of thing, and, you know, mentioning that to a few Bolton fans and, you know, seeing their interest get piqued immediately, that was really what kind of led me to the conclusion, okay, there really is going to be some interest in this. And the transfer kind of request, I'm sure we'll get onto them, but it's quite an interesting thing because, I never set out to kind of try and, you know, do a real kind of a hatchet job on that and kind of destroy the legends that have been built up around him. And I hope through the book, by mentioning the fact that he, you know, he entertained the idea of leaving the club and things like that, it adds a human element to his story and goes some way to kind of enhancing his legend by humanising it rather than, you know, making people question if he was that dedicated. And I hope by reading it, it's obvious that I'm still on the very much the side of the fence that his dedication went beyond all kind of reasonable expectations.
Yeah, I would definitely second that. I mean, Gary, I'll come to you first. And this is something we talk about quite often on here, and certainly depend on the guests and the books. But, you know, we talk about social history or oral history in this case, and, you know, and I think, you know, all three of us, including Stephen, are strong believers in the sort of the keeping alive of stories and the keeping alive of players' journeys, if you like, through the game. Certainly for the younger generation who maybe don't necessarily know much about Nat Lofthouse or aren't aware of him, you know, these books, you know, and this, like that Matt's written, you know, and we did one on Jimmy Greaves earlier, they're so important that we have these detailed accounts available.
They absolutely are. And when I was sort of going through the book, and this is my sort of moment when I know we're going to do a pod on these things, I was making a few notes, and one of the first ones I'll put is that it brought the legend to a new younger audience who may not have known about it now. And I think Matt was right that, you know, he also put a human face on the legend, and, you know, nobody's all perfect, but this is a guy who's a legend of football, you know, there's no doubt about it. You know, this isn't some kind of, you know, player who played three times for England. You know, he played 30 goals in 33 games for England. He's exceptional. You know, his record for Bolton and the things he achieved, even after he's finished playing, are worthy of record. And it's important that as we go through, because football's such it dominates the world now for sports fans on TV all over the place, and you get players now who are pumped up stars, and this is the real legend of football. And, you know, as you say, it's important that you get the history laid out. Matt's done a fantastic job of doing just that thing.
Stephen, we live in a, you know, you and I both have children, and we live in this social media 24-hour sports news world that we live in, you know, with YouTube and everything. And players, you know, contemporary players, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi, Aguero, we've mentioned, Mo Salah, you know, all of these players, there is so much out there, you know, the click of a button or the touch of a fingertip for the younger generation. But like I say, it's the, you know, the players that not necessarily formed the game, but certainly players who have played a massive part in the history of the game, you know, it's just as important, and it has to be through the medium of books, that we can bring these characters to a younger generation.
Oh, completely, and more so that as the generations move on, then you start to lose the people who saw these players play. It's really massively important to be able to, you know, speak to people that saw, you know, the likes of Matt Lofthouse play. And the interesting thing about Matt Lofthouse is that, unlike many of his era of player, he was still around until just a short few years ago. He only died in 2011, which is part of why his story has never really been told in such an in-depth and upfront manner, really, I think. You know, because when you look at someone like Stanley Matthews, who, you know, we lost about 20, at least 20 years ago now, you know, the story's told. And that's not to say that, you know, Lofthouse has been ignored. It's just that he's remained omnipresent and in his later positions as being kind of like an omnipresent figure at Bolton Wanderers. He almost remained part of the fabric of the club in modern times as well as in the past. So this figure of Lofthouse was, you know, still there, really. So it's been difficult to tell his story, and the fact that Matt's been able to stand up and do it, it's the first step forward in bringing that back to life in a way.
Matt, I mean, your book is, I don't mean ambitious in terms of, you know, sheer size and scale and number of pages, etc., but it's ambitious in that, you know, it covers, you know, pretty much his, you know, his entire life, you know, which is, you know, no sort of no mean feat to, you know, to undertake the entire life of any character, but let alone, like you say, a one who has the backstory that Dot Lofthouse has. Was it always your intention to include as much as possible? Did you ever countenance maybe part of his career or a certain element of his career?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the things that I think there was a, certainly for me personally, there was a major kind of blind spot in my knowledge was really the kind of day in, day out of his Bolton career. So obviously mentioned the Matthews final and the 58 final and his exploits for England, but really I couldn't have told you he was ever first division top goal scorer. I couldn't tell you he was the player of the year in 1953. So initially, that was where my focus lay. But as kind of time wore on, I kind of, mainly for my own interests to begin with, I started doing some research around his family history and also the kind of social history around Bolton and Lancashire. And initially, it started to try and just give some context to, again, to sort of with a younger generation of fan in mind, who's, you know, perhaps accustomed to a player joining for a fee from another club, maybe even another country, playing for the club for a few years, and then kind of that's the end of it, really. And you know, Bolton have had players who kind of fit that mould in the last since I've been watching them, who you know are bona fide legends of the club. You know, the likes of JJ Okocha and Ivan Campo. What I wanted to do with those fans in mind was try and give some context to exactly why Nat, I don't want to say meant more than the kind of modern legends of the club, but why football was so important to people, why it was, you know, you've already mentioned this sort of 24-hour news cycle and social media and all that. And, you know, obviously you've got the likes of the Manchester City's kind of Chelsea and that kind of thing with millions and billions of pounds being pumped into them, and it can feel a little bit like the original purposes of the clubs, which was really a community pursuit to give people an escape for 90 minutes from the kind of drudgery of everyday life. So I felt that was important, and as I did more research, I kind of added more and more to that. I did have a version of the manuscript which went into, on reflection, quite ridiculous amounts of detail about his family history and, you know, sort of charting them way, way back and, you know, sort of rereading sections about his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather being born pretty close to Goodison Park if it had existed 100 years before it did, and sort of eventually coming to the realisation that perhaps that was slightly too niche and perhaps only I would possibly find that interesting. So that unfortunately didn't make the cut. But then, so I'd kind of thought, right, I'll need to obviously include his childhood then and the context around why football was so important as he was growing up and became a player. And then what I learned from speaking to people interested in who work at the club and interested in the club was the role he played after. And so I knew he'd been the manager of the club briefly for an unsuccessful period. I knew he'd been a scout and a coach. What I didn't appreciate was the role he played in saving the club. So once I kind of understood that, it made absolute sense to include his entire life, because obviously outside the bulk of his career, you had this kind of arc between football kind of being the absolute fulcrum of life in Bolton and obviously towns like it as Nat was growing up, and through to the sort of 1980s when he played an absolute pivotal role in saving the club from bankruptcy. So it was a kind of a nice arc, and obviously, unfortunately, the book obviously came out in July, and since then Bolton have been in the news for all the wrong reasons, and there were points when it was looking very desperate about the future of the club. So it's kind of it's funny the way it's all worked out, and obviously it looks like Bolton are out of the woods, in for a pretty rough season this year, but it's added a kind of an extra element to the book coming out when I initially agreed the release date with the publishers, the phrase my publisher used was, "Oh, if we release it in July and we can capitalise on the enthusiasm for the coming season." Obviously, when the book came out, it was not clear at all if Bolton were going to have any future season, so that didn't quite work out. But I've had a lot of fans message me since the club was taken over a few weeks ago, and basically say, I bought the book when it came out and I couldn't bring myself to read it until I knew it was going to be okay, because the thought of kind of reading about all this history and Nat saving the club, knowing that the club was about to go to the wall, was too much for some people. So it's been a really interesting kind of parallel between Nat growing up and, you know, I think events around Bolton and Bury in the last couple of months have kind of thrown into stark relief exactly what football still means to people, even in the days of, you know, modern superstars and players earning incredible amounts of money and yeah, like we said, kind of a very, what in many ways a very different type of sport, it still inspires the same enthusiasm and community spirit and sense of belonging and purpose that people had in that day.
I could listen to that all day. I love that sort of discussion, and it's and while, you know, we're here to talk about the book and you know, and that's exactly what we're doing, and you know, like, you know, Stephen, Gary and I are so lucky that we get to, you know, we get to read these books and we get to speak to authors like yourself, and it's trying to make the listeners believe that either the book is worth buying or it's worth the investment, you know, in time that it takes to read them, and this, you know, and as you've just said there, if that doesn't appeal to a fan of football, not necessarily a fan of Nat Lofthouse, not necessarily a fan of Bolton Wanderers, but to a fan of football, that piece there that, you know, that you've just discussed is, you know, is one of, it doesn't matter the subjects that we now talk about and the bits that we talk about his career and pick out within the book, what you've just said there is the exact reason why people should buy this book and why people should write books like this. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Gary, again, it's something we talk about, social context behind the story of a footballer or behind a particular issue that we like to talk about. You know, social context is so important.
Absolutely. And the first part of the book, Matt sets the scene wonderfully for the environment which Nat Lofthouse grew up in and how the environment around him and the political environment around the world and the start of the Second World War also sort of shaped the way he would be developed. It enhanced his opportunity to get into the first team, because a lot of players obviously were called up for national service. And And it also, Matt also details how he was taken into being part of the Bevan boys, the miners, and how he worked on in the coal mine, how it gave him an important realisation of how life is for some people and how important it is to give them joy when you can. And the social context is a massive part, especially of the early part of his career and the chances he got because of the war, and also as he sort of realised how fortunate he was and how he could enhance people's lives.
It is. I mean, like you say, it's a fascinating story, and the arbits we're going to come on to, but just before we, like I say, I suppose we dip into the book, if you like. Stephen, this is a story really that or Nat's a character who links, I suppose, modern day football and the issues that can almost affect modern day football with, I suppose, olden day football or yesteryear or pre-war, however you want to word it. You know, this character in this book seems to link the two worlds of football.
Probably more so than anyone else. I can't think of another example where someone bridges such a wide chasm, certainly in the English game. To go from, playing in the era that he did to, still being involved with Bolton so late in his life. And like we said, like Matt said, the very survival of the club and managing the club and having that ambassadorial role as well. You know, I can't think of a single example of anyone in the British game that has such a wide span. There's not Nat Lefthouse.
It is, and like I say, when I thought I knew the story, it turns out I didn't know the story at all. So Matt, Gary's mentioned it there, sort of the tragedy of war became an opportunity for Nat Lofthouse in terms of selection, playing the game, playing as a professional. Gary's mentioned being one of the Bevan boys, which was certainly something I wasn't even sort of socially aware of, let alone, the link that it had with this professional footballer.
Yeah, it's, again, I think I say in the book, if you try and conjure up the idea of a stereotypical 1950s footballer, a lot of the kind of stereotypes you're probably going to draw on are probably taken pretty much directly from Nat's own story. So as well as being the kind of, no holds barred, bruising, kind of almost indestructible player. I mean, Nat's famous quote is that in his day, players would kick your bollocks off. sorry, I didn't know if I was allowed to say that. They'd kick your bollocks off. But the difference was in his day, after the game, they'd shake your hand and help you look for them. he signed for Bolton on September the 4th, 1939, and any history buffs listening will know that's not a fantastic date because that's one day after England has declared war on Germany in what ended up being the Second World War. Like you've already mentioned, pretty much the entire Bolton first team at the time ended up enlisting. And going overseas. So there's an absolutely fantastic book that came out probably about 20 years ago now, which Nat himself was quite involved with, called Wartime Wanderers, which just details the story of the club during those times. And the likes of Harry Gosling, who was the club captain, who was eventually killed in action. Nat basically signed for the club, made his debut in 1941. Like you say, in kind of very exacting circumstances, it's not many 15-year-olds get to make the debut for the hometown club, but Bolton were absolutely desperate and were actually the next season had to basically shut down because they just couldn't afford to keep the club running on the crowds they were getting in. He was then, as soon as he reached enlistment age at 18, rather than being sent overseas, he was actually, like you say, put into the Bevan boys scheme. And although he was personally disappointed about not getting to go overseas, which is pretty indicative of what that was like, a lot of miners had actually enlisted in the army because working in the mines was so horrendous. And again, it's not something I knew an awful lot about going into the project, but it's a book by George Orwell just before he wrote 1984, where he basically goes around Lancashire talking about how absolutely awful everything is. And the mines play a big part in that, and it's pretty harrowing, the kind of stuff that miners had to do. And true to Nat's pretty much entire life, he started in a fairly cushy job, pushing kind of empty carts around on the surface. Didn't really like that, so what demanded to go below ground, ended up doing that, but still doing the same job, which was still too easy for him. So he ended up pushing the carts, but when they were fully loaded with coal, and he obviously ended up crediting that to a lot of the strength he became known for as a player.
Gary, when you look at the Second World War, and you can look at it one of two ways, in how it was opportunism for certain players, but also stalled the careers of a lot of footballers. It tragically ended a lot of careers for footballers as well. And the Second World War serves as a really almost blunt instrument, if you like, for dictating the path of many footballers, not just Nat Lofthouse, but many footballers.
Yeah, absolutely it did. Yeah, and Matt's book doesn't only concentrate a bit on the story of Nat Lofthouse in the Second World War, but also the players they mentioned that enlisted to fight, and some of them died. There's just so many millions in such tragic circumstances. But it did also shape football. And when the Second World War was over and football kicked off again, shall we say, then it was a different game, and people were flocking to the grounds to watch games because they had this sort of joie de vivre, a sort of a release from the tensions of the war. And Nat Lofthouse was, I would say, became an instant hero, but became a hero to so many who were looking for heroes, not wartime heroes, but people they could relate to in real life. And Nat Lofthouse was very much of that genre.
Just after the war, Matt, and I'll come to Stephen in this in a sec, but the Burnden Park disaster that he was there, and again, it's my own self-confessed ignorance, where you think you know something, but it's only upon reading and which players were there, the way what happened in the incident, and then the way the game continued, despite the incident, was something that I ashamedly wasn't aware of.
No, I don't think there's any shame in that, to be perfectly honest, because I'd count myself exactly the same. I think it's, again, quite like that. It's one of those events that, pretty much every football fan of a certain age would be able to say, yeah, there was a disaster at Burnden Park, but the exact circumstances have been kind of lost to time. Like you say, it's a tragedy. 33 people died. What is interesting is, firstly, the reasons. So the main draw was Stanley Matthews playing. So it was an FA Cup quarterfinal. And Stan Matthews at the time, I don't think there's a player around today that can quite command the same kind of magnetism of fans, I guess you'd say. So one of the factors involved was fans of literally neither Stoke or Bolton, but Blackburn, Blackpool, all these fans from around Lancashire, basically desperate to get a look at Stan Matthews playing. There was obviously post-war, so there was, their joie de vivre of finally being able to go to a football stadium and not fear being bombed, because that was an actual factor during wartime. They had to restrict the number of people allowed to gather in one place at a time in case there was a bombing. It was Bolton's last home game of the cup run, and basically just massively oversubscribed. For people not familiar with Burnden Park, Bolton's home ground, there was one end, which was called the embankment end, which was effectively led up to a railway line, which is still there, unsurprisingly. Effectively, it was a large set of, I guess you'd call it, steps with a few kind of measly safety barriers dotted around here and there, and it turned into a crush basically. And what one of Nat's big kind of crusades in later life, firstly was around kind of hooliganism, but also he was absolutely steadfast in his support of trying to make football safe and encourage fans to come of kind of all ilk. So he wanted to see families, he wanted to see parents not afraid to send their children to football matches and that kind of thing. And so when Hillsborough happened, he was absolutely devastated, and kind of part devastated, part furious that effectively that the Burnham Park disaster, which was very, very similar to Hillsborough in a lot of ways, had been allowed to repeat itself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, Stephen, I was going to come to you and, you know, and sort of the similarities. You know, we mentioned, you know, at the beginning this, just before, we mentioned how, you know, this career of Nat Lofthouse spans across two different worlds, and yet you could argue that the link or the key similarity, if you like, the two defining factors almost, are these two stadium disasters almost 3-4 decades apart, and yet were still so similar in incident and effect.
Yeah, it's the fact that it must be so frustrating for a person like that to have lived through it at a younger age, exactly the same way, only to see it unfold again over 40 years later in virtually identical manners. And yeah, to see that nothing was gleaned, no long-term lesson was learned from Burnham Park. And as Matt's alluded to, kind of like the pull of Stanley Matthews for that game, what you also had to weigh into the fact was that it was the first season after the end of the Second World War, and there wasn't a league campaign that season. It was simply the FA Cup. So these cup games were extra, there was extra emphasis on them. They were played as two-legged games. So these were oases, basically. And you can't imagine the devastation. I mean, I lived through Hillsborough through peacetime. And for people to have come out the other side of the Second World War to go and die at a football match is absolutely incredulous. And yeah, you know, for Nat Lofthouse to have lived through that and then to see it all happen again 40 years later is just crushing.
I mean, you know, I feel like I've brought the mood down of the whole discussion, and I am really sorry. However, you know, it's clearly an important part. But like I said, really, we've only just started to touch on his career, Matt. But if I can just sort of talk to you about his England career, if that's okay. And you know, this, you know, he makes his debut in 1950, and it's only, I say only, 33 games. For the England side, you know, there's the moniker of the Lion of Vienna, there's a World Cup campaign, but it's only 33 games, is what I can't get my head around.
Yeah, and once again, I'm with you there. you look at the fact he scored 30 goals in those 33 games, and yeah, you do wonder how on earth did that happen? And again, sort of harking back to earlier versions of the manuscripts, didn't quite make the cut there. I think that there was one where I kind of had to do a sort of Alan Partridge style expunging, because I realised, rather than, well, where Alan Partridge would say, needless to say, I had the last laugh, I was saying stuff like, needless to say, the England selection committee made an absolute balls up of it again. because, yeah, basically in Nat's day, obviously, one factor in playing fewer games is England just generally played fewer games. They played the home nations tournament each season. They played a couple of prestige friendlies against foreign nations. And then they play a sort of end-of-season tour, which generally consists of two or three games. No European championships, and so no qualifying. They were obviously, like you say, entered into the World Cup for the first time in 1950 and played in 54 and 58 as well. But the qualification for those was effectively the home nations championships they were already playing was made into the qualification. So I think on average now England play around sort of 5 or 6 more games a season than they did in those days. So that was one factor. Another was no substitutes. So whereas today, I think I'm right in saying Marcus Rashford, he's obviously, I don't even know, I think he's in his early 20s now, I'm not entirely sure, but I think he's now about to overtake Nat in terms of total caps, which is, without meaning to disrespect Marcus Rashford, slightly mind-boggling.
I don't think he listens, you're all right.
Yeah.
Of course he listens.
I might get Man U fans on my case for that, but... yeah, so that was another factor. But yeah, the sort of overriding factor was England in those days. Walter Winterbottom was he was nominally the manager, but that actually more amalgamated itself as the coach of the players. The actual selection of players was done by a committee, which was made up of FA kind of hierarchy, and also chairman of various football clubs. And so there was a lot of politics there. The scouting network, obviously there was no televised games really. The scouting network was a lot more feeble. So basically if you had a good game for England, there was a good chance they wouldn't bother going to see anyone else. If you had a bad one, there was a good chance they'd go and watch someone else, think, yeah, he'll do. They wouldn't even give you a chance. Nat played in an era of fantastic forwards. So you had the likes of Tommy Lawton, Stan Mortensen, Jackie Milburn. And as much, obviously I'm biased and I look at 33 caps and feel scandalised and think he should have been kind of at least on a par with someone like Tom Finney, who got into the 70s or 80s. But then you look at someone like Jackie Milburn, who's obviously an absolute sort of the Newcastle United's equivalent of Nat, and were it not for Alan Shearer, I think would probably be the only player in English football who's capable of giving Nat a run for his money in terms of what he means to one single club and what he achieved with one single club. But Milburn barely got a look in. Stan Mortensen was another fantastic striker. He basically had his England career ended by the infamous match of the century against Hungary, where England obviously lost 6-3, and the selection committee looked at the systemic issues which led to that huge hammering defeat. Looked at the fact England scored 3 goals and conceded 6, and thought, you know what, that was the centre forward's fault, so he's not going to play again. I was worried I was starting to kind of beat a dead horse with the selection committee bashing by the end of it, but there's a couple of matches where for no apparent reason they decide for this match only one player from each club is allowed in the England squad. No real reason why. They did it for one game and thought, oh, that's a terrible idea, let's not do that again. But that kind of sort of undemocratic thinking, I guess you'd say, played a big role. And generally, I mean, again, if you look down Nat's record of goals and games, there are just exclusions which kind of boggle the mind. I mean, he was dropped just before the match of the century, the 6-3 against Hungary, and basically didn't play for England again until the World Cup. And in a way, he was actually very fortunate because he also missed losing, I think it was 7-1, the reverse game against Hungary. But it's, yeah, slightly baffling that someone with that record, who was by that point already known as the Lion of Vienna for his heroics, England could be going through such turmoil and the selection committee never gave him a chance, really. Squad's also very, very slim, so it wasn't like, you know, we'll call up 3 forwards and see who does best in training for the week and then play them. It was very much this is the team you're going to play because we happen to like this guy right now. We haven't bothered to go up to Bolton and watch Lofthouse play, but there you go.
I mean, you know, for you, Gary, where does, you know, I'm not saying where does he rank in the all-time greats? It's an impossible question, but I think he certainly deserves, you know, when you have your a title such as the Lion of Vienna, you know, you there has to be some sort of recognition for his international career, albeit, as you know, as Matt's wonderfully explained, the reasons why it was relatively short.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Matt sort of hit the nail on the head there, because he was fortunate or unfortunate, if any you want to classify it, to be born into an era where there were a number of players who were sort of vying for the same position, you know, Terry Morton, Jackie Milburn, Mortensen, and I think even in the World Cup in 58, 54, 58, he got dropped for Derek Kevin. So I think there was sort of a massive amount of competition for the centre-forward position at the time. And, you know, in another era, you know, those 30 caps could have been the 70 that that Matt alludes to as being sort of a lot more appropriate for a guy of that calibre. And, you know, it's to his credit that he actually played 30-odd games, because 30 games for England in that era probably equates to 60 or 70 for the very reasons that that Matt mentioned. You know, England play probably twice as many games, at least twice as many games now per season as they did in those days. And also the fact that, you know, in most international games, three or four or five subs come on, especially in friendlies, sometimes more than that. So the caps there are probably an understatement of his worth, A, to England, and B, in the history of England centre-forwards.
I do hope that Marcus Rashford is listening to this and is a little bit more circumspect about his international career and actually has a little bit of self-perspective on what he's achieved so far in the game, just in case he's listening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of Rashford, he doesn't do anywhere near enough shoulder barging for my liking anyway. I want to see a lot more of that
We'll come to that in a second. You know, Stephen, it does. I mean, you seem to be getting all the contemporary perspective questions, and I apologise for that. But it does put into perspective, doesn't it, what Matt's just said there about, you know, the greatness, if you like, and how, you know, and how the term great is overused, and but the greatness of players then and the perceived greatness of players now they're just on two completely different scales.
Oh, totally. I mean, but what you have that. As part of that is that, yeah, players are now being told that they're great, and, you know, we might not necessarily agree with that, but they will believe what they're being told. Whereas players of the Nat Loftus era, they were true greats, yet the vast majority of them were totally unassuming. And, you know, I fully subscribe to what Matt's saying about the English selection committee for England internationals. It was ludicrous. It wasn't even a case of players being informed a lot of the time. It was a case of, you know, it was almost like a cap was handed out, almost like a carriage clock, because someone had done a good job and served the club well for a certain number of years, and they deserved the recognition. That was sometimes how the selection committee will quantify the calling up of a player. And it was absolutely ludicrous the way that they would do it. And yeah, for Loftus to play so few games in comparison, even within the shorter number games of the era, is still mad. And Matt drew, you know, parallel to Tom Finney there in how many games that he played in the same era. Loftus struggled in the same way that Matthews did. Because I could be wrong here, but I'm sure Stanley Matthews didn't win 50 caps for England, or if he did, it was only just over. You know, I'm pretty sure he won, you know, a significant number less than Finney did, for instance, because sometimes they rivaled each other for a place in the side rather than both playing in the same side.
It's funny you mentioned Stanley Matthews there, and I suppose, you know, we could argue that the selection policy of England through the ages is a podcast all by itself. But the sounds of it, I'm pretty sure we could easily fill an hour with that as well. But I just want to come to now, when the book arrived, Matt, I'm not going to lie, the first thing I turned to was the two cup finals. I'm not great at reading books in order, and it's a habit I need to get myself out of. But the two, I suppose, almost like iconic moments, iconic cup finals, however you want to look at it, when... you know, Matt Gary will buy into this as well, but when you used to watch the Cup Final as a kid at our age in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, and there would always be some montage of historic FA Cup Finals, and both, you know, the 53 and the 58 Cup Final would always be a part of it. And I suppose, you know, I keep coming back to my gaps in knowledge, but I was so interested to see the parts that it played in these two Cup Finals. You know, and being a member of the Matthews Cup Final is almost enough, you know, to be in that game. But then to have that iconic moment in the 58 Cup Final that I would imagine 95% of true football fans will have seen, you know, it's incredible, almost, I suppose, borderline greedy that he has those two Cup Finals on his record.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, really, because I think, really, if you were to break down, say, the, I don't know, top 10 most iconic, not even FA Cup, just Cup Finals in general, I think Bolton have a fair stake to say three of them, because as well as 53 and 58, they also have 1923, which is the first FA Cup final at Wembley, the White Horse final, yeah, when, you know, approximately half of the British population were there to watch it. But yeah, it's obviously played different roles in both finals. The 53 final, the 53 final is a really, really bizarre game. I mean, I think the entire thing is on YouTube if anyone's inclined to go and watch it. It's just a for a kind of 4-3 with two goals in the final minute, and yeah, kind of you've got injured players scoring, you've got Matthews, you've got Mortensen scoring one of, if not the first FA Cup final hat-trick. You've got, obviously, Lofthouse, like, smashing in a pile driver from about 30 yards out. It's fair to say that makes it sound way better than it actually is. It's a bit of a mess, basically. And Bolton, for those who don't know, Bolton went 3-1 up. One of their players, Eric Bell, was badly injured but had managed to score the third goal and was basically shoved out on the wing. And pretty much Stan Matthews hadn't really bothered to break out of a jog all game. And suddenly Blackpool start passing the ball to him and he starts, you know, with about 20 minutes to go, everyone's thinking he must be, you know, I can't remember his exact age at this point. I think he's about 38. But, yeah, there's just a sense of inevitability. You can pretty much see the Bolton players' heads drop even before sort of anything really happens and the comeback sort of amalgamates. But, yeah, the 58 final was obviously different for a number of reasons. I mean, ironically, were it not for the Munich air disaster, that the final would have almost certainly been kind of celebrated as Nat's equivalent of the Matthews final. You know, Matthews was the people's champion going into the 53 final. Everyone wanted him to win. When the final whistle goes, Kenneth Wolstenholme, the commentator, basically says something along the lines of, it's a fine end to a wonderful career. Little did anyone know Matthews was going to still be playing 12 years later and, sort of apparently ageless. But, yeah, the 58 final was obviously very different because of the Munich air disaster. And it's that was probably one of the most interesting things from my perspective to research, because I think a lot of players over time kind of changed what they sort of, I guess, thought about it. I'm not accusing anyone of, you know, sort of reneging on their true feelings or anything like that. Obviously, as time moves on and emotions change, but Nat obviously had played in the England team with a lot of the Manchester United players who passed away in Munich. There was no doubt that people were rooting for Man United, and a couple of the Bolton players actually said that, well, this is the interesting thing. Nat was absolutely determined to win the FA Cup. There's no doubt about that. He was heartbroken by the Munich air disaster because he lost people he'd kind of mentored, but people he'd played alongside as well. But And that was echoed by other Bolton players. But there were others who, so someone who a lot of football fans may not know, but who is, again, a true Bolton icon, Roy Hartle. He was a kind of iconic sort of hard man fullback, and him and Tommy Banks, who's still with us and who I was able to interview for the book, had a reputation of giving players what they called gravel rash, because the Burnden Park had quite a steep drop, a little bit like Old Trafford today. The difference is at the bottom of the drop there was just gravel. It was a gravel track, and so if any wingers got a bit too fancy for their liking, they would give them a robust challenge and send them down the drop, basically. But yeah, Hartle in the lead up to the 58 final, he was, although he hadn't been as involved with the Man United players as some of them, they all used to go out drinking after games, that sort of thing. They Bolton players used to socialise in Manchester because they were scared they would get caught by a director of the club and fined, so they all went to Manchester to do the drinking. And yeah, Roy Hartle said he was in tears on the way to the stadium after the game. He didn't want to do a lap of honour. He just wanted to pretty much forget the whole thing had happened, really, which is remarkable for a player to say, because in those days the FA Cup was the trophy. It had more prestige than the league. There was no European Cup, and to hear a player of his repute as well, of being such a bruising archetypal 1950s footballer, basically say he was just so upset he couldn't enjoy it. That kind of tells you all you need to know around the emotions of the final. But obviously, Nat was able to lighten the mood by scoring one perfectly legal goal and one goal, which, again, I don't think there'll be anyone listening who hasn't seen it. Basically, the ball loops up in the air. Harry Gregg turns around to catch the ball. And Nat, I mean, again, I don't think I'm biased, but I would say he caresses the ball into the net for a perfectly legal finish. And, yeah, all's good. There's no controversy. It was actually, it's an interesting one, because often that goal is held up as a kind of example of how industrial the game in the 1950s was, and how it was all just ridiculous, you know, stuff you'd never get away with in today's game. And actually, that goal at the time was pretty controversial. There was kind of debates in the newspapers afterwards, sort of. Nat kind of, I think he knew pretty early on that was a bit cheeky. But what Andrew Dean, who still works at the club, who knew Nat and worked with him for many years, said to me was that Nat, whenever anyone brought it up, Nat was always quite quick to point out with a bit of tongue-in-cheek that the game had finished 2-0. So, you know, even if that one hadn't counted, the game was Bolton's, basically.
I think anyone listening will have no clue about what goal you're talking about from that description of caressing the ball into the net. you know, Gary, you know, like we say, you know, these are iconic, you know, these are iconic moments, and it's, and I suppose, you know, as Matt's just said there, you know, that goal there is the, you know, as Matt's just said, it is the definitive image of the perception of football before it became the modern game. It's almost the defining image of what football used to be.
Yeah, it is, and you know, I understand Matt's sort of finessing of the description, but you know, I think people will say, "Oh, that would never be allowed today." Well, it doesn't matter, because it wasn't played today. When it was played, it was allowed, you know. And Matt's mentioned the book a couple of times, that how coaches said to Nat Lofthouse, I want to say that you can run, you can shoot, and you can head, and those are things you need to concentrate on. Is that right, Matt? Am I right?
Yeah, that was it was actually a bit of a dressing down for Nat after he'd had his first England cap. By his own admission, had a stinker of a game, and his longtime coach, George Taylor, called him into his office and said, "You're good at three things. You cannot pass, you cannot dribble. Just forget all the fancy stuff. I don't care what you try to what the England coach have tried to drill into you. Forget it. You can run, you can jump, you can shoot, and that's it. And that's all I want from you.
Yeah, and so this is the guy who having been sort of told this is your sort of strong suit, deployed his strong suit, and Matt mentioned sort of semi-jokingly earlier about assault shoulder charges. That was part of the game then. Now it's not so much part of the game now, but Matt Lofthouse wasn't playing now. If he was playing now, he played a different game, but he played the game to the structure that was inherent in the game at that time. So I think it's important that we sort of, it's easy to sort of say, oh, well, that wouldn't have been allowed. But it was allowed because it was the sort of thing, the way the game was played in those days. So, you know, we shouldn't devalue a guy who played the game as it was played at that time.
I absolutely agree. Like I say, when I'm trying to educate my students what the game was like when I was a kid, never mind what it was like in the 1950s, and they refuse to believe me of what it was like. You know, like we say, Stephen, it's one of those defining moments, isn't it? But it's the way. I know Matt's can hear what I'm about to say, but it's one of the reasons why this book works, because it brings to life, you know, we've seen this moment so many times, you know, the clip so many times, but a book like this, you know, I suppose, which is how we started the podcast, it brings so much more than just the clip and so much more of the incident. It tells the whole story, doesn't it? Even just around a single goal.
Oh, it does, because what you get with a player like Nat Lofthouse is because there's so little footage to draw on. You know, if you're looking at a player in the 70s or the 80s, there's loads of footage that you can pick up on and to be able to translate that into words. When you're looking at a player like Nat Lofthouse, you don't have all that much, and what there is there is this. You know, one of the few great bits of footage of him is this iconic moment when he delicately puts the ball in the back of the net. But what it is that it's almost becoming, it's like a cartoon character as such. It's what it makes them, you know, Stanley Matthews is exactly the same way. It's that dip of the shoulder at Wembley in the 53 final. You know, for Tom Finney, it's that iconic splash through the water at Stamford Bridge that they made that brilliant statue out of at Deepdale. And the books like these, and Matt has done it perfectly, is to bring these almost cartoon characters, black and white cartoon characters, to life and to give you a fuller picture of an image that you have in your head.
I mean, like I say, Matt, we're already over the hour, but like as I said before, it's all right because I'm in charge, so we can do that. there's a couple of things. I mean, one, you know, you started off by mentioning, you know, his career, you know, his entire career at Bolton, head, you know, his head was turned. There were moments, and I suppose I want to finish with an impossible question, the what if question. But before we get to that, I suppose, you know, just a little bit really about post career, post playing career. So once, because that, you know, again, I suppose we could have done this in two parts. That the whole post playing career is another story in its entirety, and I suppose you could have looked at, had you wanted to, and kept the unedited version that you keep telling us about, you could have turned it into two volumes.
Yeah, the director's cut,
yeah.
which has 80,000 words on his great-great-granddad's mining career, and goes from there. Yeah, post-playing career is pretty remarkable. So Nat retired literally 2 weeks before the pivotal PFA meeting, which effectively led to the abolition of the maximum wage. So Nat had only ever earned £20 a week, and that was only at the very end of his career. And pretty much overnight, the game changed irrevocably. You know, you have Johnny Haynes immediately earning £100 a week, and it's, you know, a matter of seven or eight years before you've got the likes of, you know, George Best living his playboy lifestyle, and for someone like Nat, who'd effectively tried to run a pub for no other reason other than people in Bolton knew who he was and thought maybe they'll come and buy a pint from me because they know I'm Nat Lofthouse. That was his retirement plan. To go from that to sort of opulence beyond his wildest dreams within a couple of years was it's a sort of bittersweet moment. But from retiring, he followed the path a lot of players did. He started coaching at the club. Then he kind of moved up the ranks quite quickly as the sort of situation, the money situation unraveled at Bolton. So they dropped out of the first division. He became manager, but by his own admission, he didn't do a good job. He basically couldn't make the hard decisions. He didn't have it in him to tell a player he was dropped. And he said, you know, if Bolton lost, he'd just go home, go straight to bed. Even if they won, he'd have about 5 minutes of enjoyment and then be worrying about what was going to happen next week. So he then became head scout, and as the money situation and the situation on the pitch deteriorated for Bolton, he was eventually sacked as head coach, which was sort of, you know, one of the darkest moments of his life, really. It sounds, you know, sort of to say losing your job as a head coach of a sort of ailing, I think by that time they were in the third division football club. So it's not great, but for Nat, it was absolutely devastating. And you know, I interviewed his son, and he just said, you know, his son didn't go into too much detail about the kind of emotions around Nat, and said, you know, he was generally kind of a sort of quite a happy-go-lucky kind of guy generally. And I think if he had any sort of worries and upsets, he generally kept them to himself. But he said, yeah, just he was just absolutely heartbroken and devastated when the club let him go. But gradually he got brought back into the folds as a commercial manager. And unfortunately, I'm going to keep saying this, that the situation at Bolton was it had a couple of sort of moments when it appeared to be turning around. They returned to the first division, but again, the sort of explosion of money in the game basically did for them. They just couldn't remain financially viable for long. They kept sort of, every relegation was a potential kind of nail in the coffin almost, and so it reached the point in the 1980s when the club was on the brink of going out of business entirely. The sign of behind the scenes at the club, it was devised that they were going to start a lottery called Lifeline, which is still running to this day, actually. And basically got Nat to spearhead it. He went out onto the pitch during one game, and I should say during one game, during halftime. He didn't sort of run on like a pitch invader. But he basically pleaded with the fans to dig deep and sort of save the club, basically, and that's exactly what happened. That the fans responded, you know, fans who hadn't been to see the club since they'd been relegated in the early 60s after Nat had retired, that everyone sort of rallied round, saved the club, and pretty much anyone who was around at the time who you speak to now credits Nat with that influence. Basically said, you know, were it not for Nat championing that and putting his voice to it and giving the media a iconic name to latch onto to associate it with, it wouldn't have succeeded the way it did, and it wouldn't have saved the club. So it kind of, obviously it's a very underreported aspect of Nat's relationship with Bolton, and it's, you know, something I barely knew anything about before I started writing about the book. It's not an exaggeration to say it was his definitive contribution to the club, really. It's, you know, there would not be a Bolton Wanderers today were it not for Nat and Lifeline in the 1980s.
I'm about to ask you an impossible question, Matt, in a second about what his career would have been like, but, you know, had he have left Bolton. But while you were talking then, before that, I'm going to ask Gary an even more impossible question. Had Matt Lofthouse not arrived as a 15-year-old, or had he have not been one of Bevan's boys and gone to the front line, you know, and Matt's just talked about, you know, an immediate example of, you know, the consequence of Matt Lofthouse being there. But if you look at his whole playing career, his administrative career as well at Bolton, you seriously wonder what Bolton Wanderers would have looked like over the last 70 years had that young boy at 14, 15 not walked through the door?
Sorry about that.
Thanks, Stu. You can have that.
Who can say? I guess the answer is who can say. But it would be certainly one thing is for sure. It would have been radically different, because his contribution to the club was, I won't say defined the club, but certainly defined an era of the club, and sort for a lot of people, not Lofthouse, is almost an icon of the club. They would still have been a reasonable team. Would they have been as successful as they were winning cups? Perhaps not. Stu, you do these things, man. You pull the head of thin air. Okay, so, if there had been the same financial situation there were that Matt just described in the 80s, would they have had an iconic bloke such as Lofthouse to give that lottery a feature? I don't think they would have done so. Would Bolton still be about? Perhaps not. It's interesting to sort of consider that Bolton, bereft of Lofthouse, might not have survived. It's quite possibly the case.
I am really sorry, Guy. I did mean to ask it, clearly. I just didn't mean to make you feel bad. Stephen, you've got it, I suppose, slightly easier, really. I suppose for you, I've just come for reformation of all the random questions that I come up with or ideas that I think of.
The more the merrier, Stu. The more the merrier.
I suppose luckily for you, we can come back to where we started. And, what I've just put Gary through is, I suppose, sums up what we said right at the beginning, whereby you couldn't think of another player in the English game whose impact, not only just as a player, but also as an administrator, were almost equally important over such a prolonged period of time.
No, I can't. I really, really can't. I mean, there's been people at football clubs who've been there in over a long span of time, as comparables, not Lofthouse. But they've been at clubs where they've been able to share the burden. You know, at my club, we can point to Bob Paisley having been there for many, many years as player, and every position under the sun, all the way up to manager and even beyond as a director. But he didn't shoulder the burden on his own in the way that Nat Lofthouse did. You know, Nat Lofthouse was metronomic to Bolton Wanderers Football Club, and they'd have been a completely different entity had it not been for him. You know, they might well still be at Burnden Park now, a ramshackle Burnden Park. Living the existence of a Rochdale, for instance. No disrespect to a Rochdale, but struggling to get out of those bottom two divisions, and so much might have passed them by. They might just be that famous old name from the 1920s that didn't lift themselves after the Second World War. And yeah, Lofthouse did that for Bolton. He created a new second coming for Bolton after the Second World War.
I've decided I'm going to change the ending slightly. instead of the what if and what could have been, Matt, we'll let readers find that out and make up their own mind. We won't ask that question. I've changed my mind. Sure. I'm going to ask a different question. But I'm going to ask it. You can answer last, Matt, because you're the guest and it's your prerogative, so you get more thinking time than the other two. So my question, Gary and Stephen, now, is if you had to sum up Nat Lofthouse, either in a single statement or a paragraph, or what he meant to the game or what he meant to bowl, however you want to do it. I'm just trying to give you a bit of thinking time while I explain it.
Okay.
If you had to sum up Nat Lofthouse as an entity, how would you do it? Gary, I'm going to come to you first.
Okay. If you sum up in a sentence or so, Nat Lofthouse was an icon of Bolt Wanderers, and I think it's Matt's book has this quality that it develops a sepia picture from the era into the living Technicolor and HD, and it's a wonderful it's a wonderful skill that is deployed to give us an updated picture, to bring the legend to another group of football fans who, like the three of us, perhaps had little passages of knowledge about a guy of such stature, but now all the gaps have been filled in. So thanks for that, Matt.
Just say that again, Gary, because I'm just thinking this could go on the back of another edition of Matt's book, that it's brought the sepia picture into HD.
It's brought the sepia picture from the 50s, you know, a black and white picture, into living Technicolor in HD as well.
Love that. I absolutely love that.
I'm going to change my Twitter bio to that, man.
And so,
that's very, very kind. Thank you.
We'll talk for you later, Matt.
Stephen, you've now got to follow that, I'm afraid.
I'm not sure I can, because Gary's stolen the line there. Not about the CPU for HD. I couldn't have done that there. But, yeah, he Lofthouse was just iconic. You know, he carried a club, you know, that's doing disservice to the players that he served with, but, you know, he carried the light for Bolton Wanderers in dark times. He was there, he was omnipresent, and when everything else seemed to fall away, you know, some of his most important work for Bolton Wanderers Football Club came after he played.
I'm gonna have a go at this, and I think, having listened to all of it, having read the book, and certainly listened to you, Matt, and, you know, listening to the two guys who were always fountains of knowledge, I think Nat Lofthouse should be on the national curriculum. Now, I'm not sure what subject, whether it should be history or PE or whatever it is, but someone like that should be studied at school. That's my perspective, having just learned as much as I've learned about him.
It is funny you mention that, because I've had a few messages from teachers in Bolton who are Bolton fans who have said, you know, they want me to go in to try and to teach today's youth, the Snapchat generation, about this mining and cotton industry of Lancashire. So I am going to do that in a few weeks. But yeah, that's very kind of you to say. But I agree. I think he's the sort of the time period he spans is, you know, I include myself in this. I was completely ignorant of the sort of the period he spanned, and I think it would be an absolutely it's a fascinating cross section of history he covers.
It is. I'm glad you're going into schools. That's cheered. I'm really happy with that, because I've now decided your book should actually just be on the English literature curriculum. That's where I'm putting it. That's where I've decided it should go.
I would be fine with that.
So if there's anyone working in the Department of Education or Ofsted or whoever it is now, if they're listening, they might want to think about this for the national curriculum. Matt, it's been brilliant. I'm not just saying it because you're here, you can listen to all the other ones if you like, but this has been by far my most enjoyable and most interesting podcast in terms of a book, of a character, of a story. It's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to come on and hear a lot of very kind words, but also just hopefully spread the gospel of Lofthouse. I will admit my blood's run cold a little bit from the comparison of the sliding doors moment between Bolton and Rochdale, but thankfully that hasn't come to pass. So yeah, happy days.
Brilliant. Stephen, thank you for, I suppose, slightly upsetting the guest now right at the end. But
I'll get my coat.
Stephen, as always, you know, brilliant. Thank you so much joining me.
A joy as always. And I'll just leave the room.
Gary, you know, a wonderful book. You know, hopefully you've enjoyed this certainly as much as I have. You know, it's a fascinating read, isn't it? It's an absolute must for any football fan.
Absolutely, and you know, we've said it a couple of times that you know, the book fills a lot of gaps. So people know a little bit about this guy. Read the book, for God's sake, read the book. it'll fill the gaps in for you, and you'll find out so much more. And Matt writes in a very engaging, empathetic way. It's an easy read for any football fan. Go and buy the book, guys.
And there you have it. Matt, once again, thank you. All that's left is for me to thank the listeners and to say thank you, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.